I'm Trudy Kerr and welcome to The Interviewer. In this series I talk to artists, campaigners, men and women of influence, musicians, performers, sportsmen and women, politicians, businessmen and women, and anyone who shapes the fabric of our society. Today's guest's Facebook page description states, visual artworks, illustrations, portraits, cartoons, visuals created by Georges Méliès, a communications academic, artist and writer living on the island of Malta, well known for his poetic art, satirical cartoons, comic strips and book illustrations. But as George says himself, he also produced radio and television programs, has produced books, magazines, and, not incredibly well, websites. I'm massively interested in anything relating to social media. George is also an associate professor and head of the Department of Media and Communications at the Faculty of Media and Knowledge Sciences, University of Malta. And if that wasn't enough, Georges Méliès has published books of fiction for children, which he has also illustrated, as well as books of experimental short stories. He produced what, at the time, was Malta's only regular socio-political comic strip, One Family, in the Sunday Times between 1993 and 2008, and his Zep, humorously mapping the COVID-19 pandemic comic strip, appears twice weekly in the Times of Malta. George, welcome to the show, but can I just tell you, that is a very intimidating resume.
I think I need to shorten it. I mean, just listening to that, I was saying, who is this guy?
This is you!
Yeah, I know. It's pretty terrible. I mean, I think the first time I actually made a CV a few years ago, I realized it came to something like 28 pages. And I said, bloody hell. and I looked back and I said, okay, what can I remove from this? And I couldn't remove anything. It was a problem.
That was horrendous. I had a 4-page resume and my partner told me, your resume has to be 1 page. George, that can't happen. Your resume is bigger than the Bible.
Well, let's just say it's not as sacred.
Let's leave it there.
I think we will definitely need to shorten that. I mean, just listening to you saying that, good God.
That's half the show done.
Yes, it is. It's really. There you go.
First up, I'm so glad that we've finally been able to meet because we've been trying to book this interview for months and months and months. So tell me, what keeps you so busy on a daily basis?
Okay. You thought the resume was long. Okay, first of all, I love my job. I have to begin by saying that, because when people hear me commenting about it, they're going to think that I hate it. I don't, actually. I love my job. I am an academic. I love my students. I love lecturing, okay? But the point is, there is an enormous amount of work involved in that. Talking to students, especially over the COVID period, was, you know, essential, and it took up most of my time. I'm also missing a couple of posts at university, which I then need to carry myself and stuff like that. So the administration of a department, which is the largest department in my faculty, with undergraduates, postgraduates, doctorate students, et cetera, doing a bit of research occasionally, organizing, you know, the occasional conference here and there. I co-organize a conference in Greece annually. We go to a Greek island every year, which is absolutely wonderful. But it is a conference. And my books and my writing and correcting and preparing and, yeah, well, full stop.
Okay, I told you, George. Just listen.
I'm a workaholic. It's a problem. I work non-stop. I can't help it. I work all the time, all the way till dinner. Then I can't after that because I have my whiskeys.
You like whiskey?
Yep, I'm a whiskey
man.
Okay,
we have another thing in common.
I'm a whiskey man.
Fantastic. We'll arrange for that later.
There we go.
But you say that it's a bit of a curse to be a workaholic, but I don't think it is because you give back so much to us. And I'm thrilled that you do. Can I just ask you, what is knowledge science?
Oh, knowledge sciences. Okay, that's the faculty name. It's media and knowledge sciences. Well, I suppose anything that contributes to knowledge and that is studied is knowledge science. So the faculty actually has cognitive science, it has library studies, it has, of course, media and communications, it has all sorts of different areas where knowledge is studied. And that is why it's knowledge sciences. Media is separate because even though media is also a study of a certain type of knowledge, but it does tend to stand by itself, if you know what I mean. So that's what it is.
But you also mentioned before we sat down to have this interview that you also mentioned that you teach graphic design.
Well, I actually, my original post at university nearly 30 years ago was in desktop publishing. That old kind
of desktop publishing.
Yes. So I was one of the first people in Malta to use Macintosh computer for online, you know, on-screen creation of a newspaper. When iCenter actually had a campaign mapping the pioneers of Apple in Malta, I was one of the poster boys.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, there you go. And so sort of that's what it was. I started teaching graphic design. I started teaching desktop publishing back then. And that remained my post until, of course, I got my associate professorship. And then sort of you tend to lose it along the way. Right now it's just a professor of communication.
I love the way that you mentioned until I got my associate professorship and blah, blah, blah. As if there was nothing. I mean, congratulations to you. And I can see that you really are a workaholic, but somebody who's very, very passionate about giving back.
Well, the passion is what drives me. If I lose the passion, I think I'll die.
I think for anybody who follows you, that is very, very evident. And I want to talk about each of these passions in turn. And I want to start off with the fact that you've just produced, you mentioned the fact that you're a workaholic, but you've just produced a book of Zep.
It's a massive book. It's 100 pages of full color A4. You know, TikTok, et cetera, et cetera. And it's going to cause the heavens to produce. So I'm actually not going to publish it in the traditional way, but it's going to be on
pre-order.
On yeah.
And for anybody who doesn't know what it is, it's the first 200 strips from the twice weekly feature in the Times.
Yes.
It's only available until the end of this month.
Yep.
So if you want to pre-order it, it has to be done before the end of April.
Indeed.
And I just love Zep, and it's one of the reasons that I started following you, because it's a really brilliant satirical look at a situation that's affected us all. Sometimes not satirical, sometimes very direct and very serious.
You're absolutely wonderful, Trudy, you know that? You're talking about a character I've created in glowing terms. My God, thank you.
Well, it's... But I'm speechless, and that never happens. But, George, this has... broken down, Zep has broken down the pandemic into a way that we can all relate to, and you're voicing what we all want to say.
Yeah, that was the
through
point.
A cartoon strip.
The point is, I was locked down like everybody else, and I live alone, so logically, sort of, it was even worse for me than for most people. And I had just gone through a bit of a trauma, and that made it all worse, you know what I mean? So I needed a creative outlet. I mean, I had already sort of just finished a 37 painting exhibition, which only lasted for a week because of lockdown. And I was working on a couple of books. I did a book for children, which sort of in a week, actually, when the schools were locked down, I wanted them to read something which was topical, which they could identify with. So I had to write this adventure about kids locked down in Malta, you know what I mean? So I did that. And then I started thinking, I said, okay, the comic strip has always been my thing. I love comic strips because the comic strip can say so much, can say much more than a single panel cartoon, because you can build it up, and then sort of demolish it in the last panel. You know, that's where the denouement is, that's where the joke is. And I kept on thinking, I said, okay, what are the funny sides of something as drastic and as negative and as unique to the world as this? So I sort of started thinking in terms of, okay, eating too much. All right, good. A woman locked up with her kids. Okay, there we go. And I started sort of looking for the sort of silver lining, a tiny bit of the silver lining, while defining what we're all feeling and putting it into words. Because very often in communications, as you know, you need to see it in other people to say, okay, it's not just me. And I wanted to put all of that so that people would say, okay, it's not just me, and laugh a bit. Because it's very difficult to laugh at yourself. But it's very difficult to laugh at somebody who's fictitious and who's reflecting your life so closely. So that's how it started.
Well,
it did develop, though. So, but that was the beginning. That was it. That was what launched it.
Well, this leads me very nicely on to something else I wanted to tackle. And that's because I love seeing on my newsfeed on social media the illustrations that you've created from the people in the media. So it might be the Pope, It might be Mario Azzopardi. It might be Putin or the murder victim, Paulina Demska, which I know was very difficult. The communication around that that you wrote had been a very difficult one. But your illustrations absolutely light up my newsfeed with these vibrant colors, but also stunning interpretations of the person of the moment. And it touches us in a way that other interpretations couldn't. I'm going to ask a number of questions. So how long have you been doing this? How did that start? And how is it that these visuals, whether it be Paulina Demska or whether it be the Pope, or whether it be Meatloaf, how is it that those touch us in a way that other communications don't?
Well, I don't know.
You're the media man. How can you not know?
Well, all I can say is this. I started drawing. I've always liked drawing portraits. I used to take photos of portraits, portrait photos of people, because I love taking portraits. And so I also like drawing portraits. I've always liked it. My style is very graphic. It's pen and ink. It's crosshatch, you know, very traditional crosshatch, sort of etching style crosshatch. So, and then colored in very basic colors, just sort of comics-like. You know, I collect comics, so I love comics, and obviously the comics coloring sort of is always there. I think it was when Robin Williams died that I first drew Robin Williams. And I realized that, you know, I was drawing somebody whose character I loved and who had just killed himself. And I wanted to put something in that face that indicated the sadness along with a smile. And I remember sort of putting shining droplets, if you like, in the eyes in order for them to look liquid, meaning there was sort of almost hidden tears there, which really, really brought it out. And that was sort of what set me going. Whenever anybody died who had influenced me in some way, whether it's a Maltese person or, you know, a big personality like Bowie and the rest of them, I just had to draw them. I just had to externalize what I was feeling. And very often, it was the awe I had of them or the feeling I had sort of, you know, for them that actually came out in the drawing. I don't try to. It just comes out. And that's where I think the punch is. I think the punch is in what I feel, and then which then is replicated in the way that faces are drawn by me.
But are they all of people who've died? Because just to make sure everybody knows, the Pope has not died.
No, nor has my mum, thank God. No, nor have I, actually, because I've
drawn
myself.
Excellent, because you did yourself portrait,
yes, a few times. But most of the time, in fact, people have got used to it now, that when anybody dies who's of any significance, they wait for my portraits. And whenever I've drawn someone, just for the heck of it, like Neil Gaiman, for example, I got this, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, sort of, has Neil Gaiman died? Because people automatically associate any portrait I post now with somebody who's died, which is not a nice thing. But there you go. I mean, I suppose that also means I've got a following for my obituary portraits, let's call them that. But most of the time, the people I draw are people who have touched me in one way or another.
This is an extraordinary story, and I love the fact that it started with Robin Williams and you wanting to bring something extra to that portrait.
Robin Williams, Bowie, and so many others. I actually had an exhibition, part of a Christmas exhibition in Sweden with the very first portraits, which went down quite well.
Well, the wonderful thing about visuals is that they talk across, they speak across every single language. Yeah. You can see it. You don't need to be able to speak in a visual language.
And you need to feel
everyone.
It, of course. You need to feel
absolutely.
It. That's the important thing.
And that's the point, is that I remember you drew, is it Nightbird?
Yes.
And I saw this young lady
that was
who
poignant.
Passed away, and I saw it, and I hadn't realised that she'd passed away until I saw your visual,
and suddenly... And the point is, I had never heard of her up to that point. And then somebody posted that she died, and I was seeing Nightbird pop up on my timeline all the time. And I just checked the video, that famous video of her where she actually talks about that.
Yeah.
And she touched me so deeply. And past 2 years have been very bad for me. I've gone through some extremely negative times. And although I'm much better now, but there are still moments where it's abject darkness. And seeing that positivity in that young girl who eventually died. I mean, she lost it. She lost the battle with cancer, which is absolutely horrible. I just had to put into images what I felt. The image was an extension of me at that point in time, wanting to be her. And even though she was dead, but she was alive. She was one of the most alive people I know. And of course, what I write along with the drawings, because I don't just draw them, I need to sort of put into words. I think one of my best friends, who's also an artist, had once said that although I dabble in a lot of arts, my actual art is the writing. And I have to admit that he might be right, that my art is actually my writing. All the rest is sort of an appendage of that, if you know what I mean. So I need to put it in there. I also need to put it into words. So the words and the picture are symbiotic, and they convey what I'm feeling at that moment. I mean, I want it to be her. I wanted to have that feeling of giddiness at life when she was so close to death.
Yes.
Absolutely wonderful.
I'm really glad that you do what you do. I had a couple of curious questions. How long do those illustrations take to do?
A lot less than most people think.
Oh, go on, surprise me.
I don't know, it varies. I mean, because I use crosshatch, which is, of course, a very, very exacting technique, because, you know, lots of little lines. There are thousands and thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of lines in illustration and drawing. Sometimes it takes me hours and hours and hours, but there are times when I can do it in an hour.
And this, of course, is above and beyond all of your other commitments as well.
Well, the point, most people are a bit shocked when, you know, they hear that somebody's died, it's out in public, and then an hour later there's my sort of obituary portrait of that person.
Hearing that it is an obituary and it's a translation and it's an expression of what's happened and a memory for that person, I am now, George, more of a fan of yours than I was before. So by the time we get to this, by the time we get to this interview, it might just be obsessive fan base.
My first groupie. My God, Trudy.
I'm going to get a t-shirt with George Malia written across, and I'm going to get one of those photographs of you, and I'm going to put it here. I'm going to wear it everywhere. Listen, let's move on to you being a writer. You are obviously also a writer and have produced a good number of books. And I was delighted to read in an interview that you have done with The Independent that your favorite author is Tolkien.
Of course he is.
And I wholeheartedly approve. But I've only just returned from a literary desert. I didn't read anything for 15 years. And then because of a work situation, I bought myself a Kindle, and now I'm reading merrily every opportunity
can
get. But 15 years I didn't read. Now, because you're a writer, I can ask you this. Do you think as society we are reading enough?
Oh, as if.
And does it really matter? Because we have Netflix and we have social media.
Yes, it
Why
matters.
Would we need to read?
Yes, it matters. Of course it matters. Television, film, comics, which I collect, books, they're all different. They all strike you differently. I mean, I'm into audiobooks heavily because when I don't have time to read, I listen to books. I have a book in the car. I have a book on my mobile, and I have speakers on every room. So I can.
Heavens above.
Yes, all of them. And I have a smart home, so everything is voice controlled.
Okay.
It's as simple as that. So, you know, I just have sort of to. So the point is this, even listening to a book is different from reading a book. And it's the same book, but it's different. Because reading a book, you're internalizing it. When it's being performed by somebody else, it's somebody's interpretation of it. If you're watching a movie, of course a movie is a completely different medium to writing, to reading, because you can get, you know, pulled into a movie. You can, of course you can, easily enough. But the techniques that are pulling you into the movie are completely different from those techniques that are pulling you into
really
writing.
Does it really matter,
of course
George.
It does.
What's the book going to give me that?
Do you always eat the same thing? You change your food, don't you?
Not regularly, no.
But you know what I mean.
Yes,
though.
I do but know
you,
what you mean.
You do have a sort of, you do have a variation in your diet.
So you're suggesting that a book plays an important role in the variation diet of what we digest.
Of what we are.
Of did you see what I did there?
Of what we become. Yeah, of course. Of course it is. The point is this, you know, I'm a certified bookworm. I don't read as much now as I used to. I don't have the time to, obviously. I wish I did, and a lot of the reading that I do is because of my work, because media and communications are constantly changing, so logically I need to keep abreast of what's happening in the world. Otherwise, I wouldn't be very good at what I do, which is as simple as that. But I love crime thrillers, for example. That's what I listen to
all the
time on my my audiobooks are all crime thrillers. I grew up with science fiction and fantasy. So I have, that was where my reading was. When I was a kid, 10 years old, I never learned how to swim. And we had a place, uncles had a place by the beach. And I would just go there, sit on the rocks, and read, two, three books a day. Enid Blyton. But there you go. You see what I mean?
George, we're heading into groupie status here. I'm getting, you're becoming my superhero in one of these books.
I'm not a superhero at all. I can't even swim, for God's sakes. Fabio Spiteri tried to teach me, poor guy.
He did,
and he's the best on the island. And he tried and tried and failed. I think that must be the first ever time that Fabio Spiteri has failed at anything.
Fabio is also my trainer, and he was on the podcast last week.
He's an ex-student of mine. I taught him when he was 10 years old, for God's sakes.
Fantastic.
Poor guy. So he sort of, when he took a photo, he took a selfie of the two of us, and he said, I'm trying to pay him back a little bit, when we started learning. And he's such a lovely, lovely man and wonderful. I'm just scared of water. That's what I'm saying.
Well, let's come back to that question of reading. Yeah. If we need to read, if we are not reading enough, how do we encourage people to read?
Not by making them read, but leaving books around. Kids, for example. The book I told you about, the one I wrote specifically for children.
Yes,
that
yes.
went viral. Literally, people were suggesting it. I was sent photos of my parents who actually printed the book out, and the kid was reading it out of a folder, and stuff like that. So, and I was getting messages like, she doesn't like to read, but this she read over a couple of days. Do you have any more? and stuff like that. Absolutely wonderful things, because it was there, it touched them. They associated with it. They link themselves to these characters who are now locked in and couldn't go out, couldn't see Granny because otherwise they'd infect Granny and they love Granny and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then a fantasy story, which sort of Maltese Harry Potter-like characters, that sort of enthralled them. So, you see, that worked.
My last question to you, through your illustrations, whether they are books or comic strips or portraits, as we've spoken about during the course of this interview, you've been able to make political comments and sometimes criticisms, and somehow, because they're filtered through a visual, they're very impactful, but they're not George Melia. It's almost like you can hide behind the visual, and it is a very welcome voice, because you get away with saying an awful lot that if it was somebody standing up on a stage speaking into a mic, they would not be able to get away with. However, in the Maltese culture, standing up and speaking out is something that is not that common.
Yeah, but I've done it.
You have done it, and you've mastered it. Do you think this is something that we should be doing more of, that
of course.
More people should be speaking out?
I was one of the first cartoonists in Malta to actually sign my name. Where everybody was using nom de plumes, etc. I only had a very, very...
But why, George, why?
Because I always believe that if I believe something, I'm going to say it, no matter how many
people
going to be offended.
Don't?
Because we live in a culture that unfortunately tends to, prefer impunity to something else. we're living in a culture, possibly because we're so tiny. You know, we're quite parochial as a people. We can't help it. We're all about Malta now, okay? We are quite parochial. And we tend to, you know, club together according to the feast we support, or the party we support, or the team we support. Not Manchester United.
Thank you.
There we go. And you know what I mean? So we're like that. So it's very easy, because everybody knows everybody, to not hide, not be able to hide. And a lot of people will want to throw a stone and then hide their hand, which is absolutely horrible. But it's because everybody's so well known here. You understand the point?
Yes.
So that is probably the reason for it.
But you've never been threatened or been called out enough to stop you.
I won't stop. No, but the point is this. If you believe something, Trudy, you have to say it. You have to. You owe it to yourself. I'm a communicator. That is my job. I'm a professional communicator. If I believe something enough, I have to say it. And I have to say it in a way that is the most effective. Cartoons are very effective.
Yes, they are.
Because people will see them. They will get incredibly angry at them, of course, if they disagree with whatever side it is that I'm attacking at that point in time. And others would laugh their heads off, and they share them, and they become a talking point. And that's what it's about. Because a cartoon will punch you where it hurts. And that's the important thing. Because if it doesn't, then it's not a very good cartoon, is it? It's a damn squib.
George Amelia, you have been everything and so much more than I hoped for. Thank you so much for being on The Interviewer. Thank you so much for your incredible contribution to society, to our thinking processes, to our reading, to everything that you do. You are brilliant, and I'm going to get that T-shirt. And if you see me stalking you outside your house, that's me, that's your groupie.
Well, and if they see me walking around now with a head too heavy for me to carry, they'll know that it's a Trudy Care Boost to the Ego. Yeah, there you go.
George, thank you so much for being. I'm so glad we made this happen.
It was a great pleasure, Trudy. Thank you so much for this.
To listen to this edition of The Interviewer again, or other exciting interviews, head towards Spotify or SoundCloud and search for The Interviewer.